Hi everybody, this is Joanne. Welcome to Read Science. I'm joined today by my co-host Jeff Schomeyer. There he is. And our guest today is Alex Hutchinson, who is an author of several books. Oh darn, I forgot to make the list of the books. But the book for today is Endure, A Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. And I came across this book because my son is an ultramarathoner. Ooh, we all have our copies. My son's an ultramarathoner, and I said, "Ooh, have you heard good things about this book?" He said, "I said, had you read it?" And he said, "No, but I've heard good things." I said, "Okay, I'm checking it out." Yeah. So yeah, we've all got copies of our books. Anyway, so Alex, in a moment, I'll ask you to remind me, because you have a book like Cardio or Weights First, something like that, right?
Yeah, I have one called Which Comes First, Cardio or Weights. I think it's Fitness Myths, Training Truths, and Other Surprising Discoveries from the Science of Exercise. So that was right. That was 2011, and much more of a sort of practical, what do we know about fitness and exercise and how to get healthy?
Right. So we know it's a science book because the subtitle's super long.
Yeah. Yeah. That one, the title was not a winner. This time, at least even the main title was really long. Which comes first, cardio or weights? This time we went with Endure. It's Endure. Like something that people, even I can remember, which was embarrassing when I couldn't remember the title of my own book.
So let me tell people a little bit about you. You are on Twitter as Sweat Science, and it's like I cannot forget that handle. It's a great handle. So Alex Hutchinson is a National Magazine award-winning journalist who writes about the science of endurance for Runner's World and Outside, and frequently contributes to other publications such as the New York Times and the New Yorker. I've seen you at the Globe and Mail, all over the place. A former long-distance runner for the Canadian national team, he holds a master's in journalism from Columbia and a PhD in physics from Cambridge, and did his postdoctoral research with the National Security Agency. So welcome. We're really glad you're here. And, you know, it's Jeff, I'm sure you're going to bring up the David Epstein and our Read Science connections, right?
We have a connection where there was a critical point in the series where after that point, every book that we read referred at least once to someone who'd already been a guest. And in your case, it was David Epstein who talked to us a little over a year ago or 2 years ago, also about sports science. So that was fun because he doesn't get enough mention in the books that we read. So. Appreciate that.
His book was great, and he's a great guy, mm-hmm. and he's been a serious mentor. And in fact, a little behind the scenes detail is during the editing process on this book, one of the early requests from my editor is, could we mention David Epstein a little bit less? So some of the cases where I've drawn on his research, because in addition to his book, he did a bunch of great sports science for Sports Illustrated, mm-hmm. and I mentioned several of his pieces, and like, okay, yeah, you've mentioned David enough, just put him in the footnotes. Okay, I sent David an email, just so you know, I'm putting you in the footnotes. I appreciate your work. We just didn't want to have too many David Epsteins in the main text.
Right. Well, he was also a great guest. We had a terrific time talking to him, and that surprised me because, as I admitted to you earlier, I'm not the world's biggest sports fan. And so I wondered how the blend in this book would be and interest me. And it only took me about half the first page, I think, to be drawn in, because there's so much sports and so much science, and they go together to make such compelling stories of things that combine what I maybe knew with things that I didn't know, but I could follow along with. And I think you should have a crossover winner here. The place where I wanted to start, I thought, can I find an entry point for sort of an overview of everything that's going to be talked about? And Endure says a lot because you're looking at all of the various types of endurance sports and what endurance means and why it is that someone who's performing in an endurance sport stops doing what they're doing before they die. And I think everyone will come to this book probably. I even came to this book with my notions of what I think the current state of the art was in why a marathoner stops running 10 feet from the end of the finish line. And all of that is wrong. And I thought I would start with a suggestive quotation from you towards the end of the book, where you're reconsidering now the question you started with, and you say, "The answer, I have to confess, isn't as obvious as I thought it would be when I first started the book." So where did you start? And then we know where you ended up, because here's the book that we'll start talking about. But where did it all get started, and what did you think the answer was going to be?
Yeah, you know, so this, we can trace this back through many layers of history, because, you know, I was, as you mentioned, I was a runner. I ran through high school and university and beyond for the national team. And I, at that point, if you'd asked me, I would have given you a very mechanistic explanation of the limits of endurance, that the body is sort of like a machine, and you know, we can, in the same way that you can analyze whether a car has enough gas in the tank and whether its radiator is overheating, and you know, whether it's, I don't actually know a lot about cars, but so my analogy breaks down here, but whether its tires have enough air in them and so on, you can look at a human and say, well, how are your fuel stores? Are you able to get enough oxygen from the air in through your lungs, to your bloodstream, to your muscles, in order to deliver to help you know, fuel your muscles to keep going? Do you have a bunch of metabolic byproducts accumulating in your mm-hmm. blood, like lactate, which are going to send signals back to your brain that are going to directly, do you have lactic acid in your muscles that is going to force your muscles to stop? So all of these things, you know, it's complicated, and there's lots of different factors, but that's the general picture that I started with, mm-hmm. is that we can understand the various pieces of the engine under the hood, and we can determine that if you are running as hard as you can and you can't, and you find you can no longer continue at that pace, somewhere there's an engine light that has lit up saying, you know, you have run out of cooling fuel or something, like, or cooling fluid, or whatever the case may be. And then now people have written that book a billion times. So I was never going to write that book, but that was my understanding. I started out as a journalist, sort of after my physics incarnation, about 13 years ago now, and I fairly quickly moved into starting to write about sports science. And at some point, I don't remember the exact time, I first started encountering some of this relatively new body of research that suggested that, you know, you don't slow down because your muscles are incapable of running at that pace anymore. You slow down because your brain thinks that your muscles shouldn't run at that pace anymore in order to preserve yourself. This sort of idea that your brain is holding you back for your own good. And that suddenly, that really clicked very, very quickly for me in terms of feeling more true to the experience of pushing your limits, whether whether you're at the gym on the treadmill or you know, out for a long hike, or whether you're racing in a 10K or a marathon or whatever the case may be. You don't really necessarily feel like there's this really neat, easily quantified limit to your, mm-hmm. you know, some days you can push farther than others. And it's like, you know, you have the same amount of blood in your body. And you know, so anyway, that clicked really quickly to me. And I thought there was going to be a very simple explanation at the other end of the spectrum, that it's all in your head. Like, you know, and I say that sort of facetiously, but I kind of, that's where I started working on this book about 9 years ago. And it was going to be a very, like, the revolutionary account of how endurance is all in your head. But unfortunately, I made the mistake of talking to a lot of scientists and reading a lot of studies. and it inevitably, you know, the more you know, the less you're able to stick to the very simple picture that you start out with. And so what I ended up with is 300 pages. I mean, I guess maybe it would have been a pamphlet if I'd stuck with my original view, but it turns out it's complicated. It's the mind and the body, and mm-hmm. and it's still, this is open science right now. Like, this is active research where people disagree with each other vehemently. Anything I say today, there will be someone somewhere in the world thinking he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's full of crap. So where I ended up is that it's not all the body, but it's not all the mind. And it's really interesting to try and think about how all this stuff mixes together.
I think my favorite telling statistic was from someplace middle of the book or so, where you say an estimated 85% of collapse in marathons takes place shortly after crossing the finish line. This suggests that there's something about stopping after prolonged exertion that triggers problems. But surely, if it tells us something, that most people make it past the finish line, they don't collapse before the finish line. And so there's all sorts of stuff going on. And of course, you said that after you'd already demonstrated there's all sorts of stuff going on. But I thought that was a very illuminating moment, that there is a reserve and there are all sorts of things involved. What an interesting story.
Right. Well, and I think, the story that really got my attention was the athlete, the mom, and her and her son got, carried out to sea. And she managed to hold her son up, until like the last moment they got the son, and that's it. That was it. She was lost.
Yeah. So two things on that. One, that story of Rhiannon Hull, the American woman who drowned in Costa Rica but saved her son. Mm-hmm. That was first reported by David Epstein in Sports Illustrated. So back to our point earlier, that's one of the places where I took David's name out and just left it in the footnotes, but he did an amazing job telling this story for Sports Illustrated. The thing is there's actually a word for this in that's used in the field, a sort of term of art called teleoanticipation, which is anticipation of the end point, that seeing the finish line coming, it's not just like, oh, happy day, I see the finish line. Your knowledge of where the finish is has dramatic effects on, your experience of whether you're close to your limits or not. And so this story of Rhiannon Hull, the woman who obviously it's hard to reconstruct exactly what happened, but it's, mm-hmm. I think she was apparently out for like half an hour in this riptide fighting until two local guys on a surfboard were able to get to her. And she was going down, but just coming back up, and she was able to kind of throw her son onto the surfboard. And then she went down and didn't come back up. It's like, that was the finish line for her, is seeing the surfboard coming. But you can see that in much more prosaic circumstances. There's this big analysis of like 9 million marathon finishers showing that, people always manage to, there's always more people just under something like the 3 hour barrier and less, fewer than expected, just over the barrier, that we, even though we're nominally pushing to our limits, we find more in the tank when we see the finish line, and especially when there's some meaningful goal attached to that finish. So there's a whole field of study trying to understand how our perception of when something is going to end affects our effective physiological limits.
Because that turns out to be a pretty tricky question when you start doing the research, right? Because it can be the psychological effects, the psychological, psychochemical effects, which becomes, as you said, one researcher pointed out, is actually physiology in the brain. It can be reserves of lactic acid maybe being converted. It can be just the notion of experienced runners being able to pace themselves so finely that they run out at exactly right. Boy, is that a tricky question.
Yeah, it's because you start out with this dichotomy of how much of this is conscious and how much of this is unconscious. Mm-hmm. And if you try and pick that apart, what you realize, it's almost impossible to draw a clear line between what's conscious and what's unconscious. And so if I have some energy left over in the last, stretch of a race, which is a kind of a universal phenomenon, whether you're a world record holder or whether you're just watching at the local 5K, everyone is able to sprint at the end of a race. And is that, how much of that is unconscious and how much of that is just, well, we planned to make sure that, we would rather run out of energy just after the finish line than just before. But, one of the things I talk about in the book is my own experiences racing, and that experience of racing 5Ks, and my 4th K was always the slowest. And then my 5th K, I'd always be able to speed up. And so I started trying to pretend that I was only running 4K to tell myself, don't worry if you have to walk the last K, just pretend you're running 4K to try and get rid of this 4th K slump. And I just couldn't do it. So this is one of the things where it's like, well, it's not as simple as just a kind of conscious decision, because I'm trying to decide not to let this happen. But it's, you know, my either some, and I don't know whether to call it conscious or unconscious. Obviously, the knowledge is I really am going to go 5K. I have that knowledge, but it seems more powerful. And so it's very hard to pin down how the brain or why the brain is making these decisions.
Well, because you had some examples too, where there could be what some people would describe as a strong placebo effect. And one of the researchers, I think for good reason, talked about it as being strong belief. Rather, she preferred strong belief as the idea rather than placebo, which sounded too snake oil or something. That having faith in what you can do or believing that you can do it seems to have some part in the whole physiological feedback mechanism.
Yeah, and you know, placebo is a dirty word for scientists, right? Because it messes up your experiments. Well, yeah. depending on the context, but it has, you know, like you said, it has a snake oil connotation. If you're thinking in an athletic context, it's like if something makes you faster, if something makes you an athlete perform better, it's like, why would you want to eliminate that? Instead, you want to harness that. You want to bottle it and sell it. So this idea that belief is a useful thing is great, but it makes it hard to, you know, and so some of the people I spoke to are live on both sides of this line. Mm-hmm. They're scientists and they're also coaches or performance physiologists. So they're like, when I'm doing studies, I try and minimize the placebo effect. When I'm talking to an athlete, I don't try and trick them. I'm not giving them sugar pills, but I try and nurture this sense of belief to bring it out. But for the science part of it, it's what makes it hard to interpret studies. And so that's one of the reasons that for me, some of the most remarkable studies are the ones that are done basically deceiving the athlete, so that you try and get away from the placebo effect by tricking them. And so there's one study, for instance, that uses subliminal images, essentially, that where they're flashing picture, mm-hmm. you know, smiling faces or frowning faces in these little blinks, 16 milliseconds long, so that they're not, no one's even aware that the images are being flashed on the wall, and it has an effect. So then you can say, well, that was a placebo effect, because they debriefed at the end of the experiment and they had no idea that there were smiling or frowning faces, and that they cycled farther and faster with the smiling faces. So for research purposes, you want to kind of get rid of that stuff.
Appealing to your inner physicist, does it seem likely to you that those, like the subliminal effects, which do show something that you can measure, do those show up? You would think, how can that have much effect? Do those show up now because other aspects of performance are so near their peak that you can start to see these smaller, what we might call second, higher order effects?
I think it's definitely a case where you can measure those effects only in the context of of a highly controlled lab environment, because if out in the real world, in the wild, there's so many things you're never going to detect these subtle effects. But so where we mm-hmm. see these effects are, like you said, it's not necessarily that everything is at its maximum, but it's everything is under a controlled condition. So mm-hmm. you're equalizing as many things as you can, but in the real world, it's just like, you know, maybe the weather is slightly better on one day, or maybe you just had a, you know, you woke up and life seemed better. So it's very hard to get these subtle effects out.
I'm imagining people with EEG in a marathon and somebody running with a cart behind them trying to keep recording things.
Yeah, or like, you know, the researcher who did the subliminal stuff, you know, and he's a very creative thinker. You know, what he was talking about is, well, maybe you get those glasses that have the heads up display where you're projecting. maybe you give yourself subliminal images, and I was like, I don't know how long you can trick yourself. That seems to me like a trick that you can use once or twice, but the possibilities are boundless. Who knows what the future holds?
Yeah, like the effect fades after a little bit. So actually here on Twitter, someone asked a question, and it turns out it's Rose George, who was on one of our first episodes, right, Jeff?
So yeah, episode 3 or so, yeah.
Yeah, so first of all, she says she's busy with the deadline panic, but she said she wants to get your book for sure, but she runs marathon distance, fell running, and trail running, and she said she wanted to know which is the better chant, strong brain or shut up legs.
Yeah, well, I kind of have to punt that question and say it probably depends a little bit on the individual psychology, but my instinct is that the positive approach, saying you're strong, brave, is more likely to trigger the kind of the equivalent of the subliminal happy face than shut up legs. Now in the book there's a whole chapter about Jens Voigt, whose motto is shut up legs. So I hold him up as a kind of paragon of pain tolerance. So obviously it worked for him, and I think it played into his self mythology of believing that he's willing to suffer more than everyone else, and that when we get into the sort of the self fulfilling aspect of sports psychology, if he's telling himself that he can suffer more than anyone else, it plays into his reputation as being willing to make these crazy breakaways early in a race. It's like, everyone knows those are painful, and he thinks to himself, well, I'm the one who can triumph in those situations. Whether he has higher pain tolerance or not almost becomes irrelevant, because he's the only one who's willing to put himself in those situations.
So shut up legs is a positive statement for him.
For him, it's positive. I can see situations though. Like let's say you're halfway, you're running a marathon, and you're halfway through the marathon, and you're focused on, you're saying to yourself, "Shut up, legs." If you're not careful, that's a way of focusing on your discomfort. You're shut up, legs, because my legs are hurting. So, I mean, I think you have to think carefully about where you're directing your attention. And so for him, it's obviously a positive thing. And I'm sure other people can use it as a positive thing too, but I think there's a danger in drawing your attention too much to how much you're suffering, as opposed to drawing your attention to the things that are going well.
Interesting. Yeah. So I was thinking about these tests, where they are really quite artificial. Like, for instance, you had one of the runners, just seemed sort of like, why am I running on a treadmill, right? So how do researchers, what do they do to try to mimic the situation the best they can? A real life running situation.
Yeah, this is a huge challenge in sports research, because if you think in the context of running, because that's what I know best, what is it like running a race versus being on a treadmill in the lab? So, I mean, the environment is different, but there's also some really fun one. One of the big issues that so a guy named Tim Noakes, a South African researcher, has been one of the real challengers of the sort of traditional view of the human body as a machine. And one of his initial challenges in the 90s was, here's the most important difference between running on a treadmill and running outside, is that on a treadmill, you don't decide how fast to go. And the fundamental, we were talking earlier about finishing sprints and things like that. When you're outside, every step is a decision. You are deciding whether to go a little bit faster, a little bit slower, or stay at the same pace. So it's a kind of a micro decision every two thirds of a second. On a treadmill, in the most common types of treadmill tests, where you just set the treadmill at one speed and you wait until the runner decides to fall off, you're only making one decision, and that's a totally different task. And so then when you look at what role does the brain play? So you're trying to study the brain's role in exercise, or the body's role in exercise. And you come to the conclusion that you can come to the conclusion that the brain isn't that important, because you're studying it in a paradigm where the brain isn't important. So a classic example of that is heat. So if you exercise in hot conditions, if you're in the lab, you let's say you put a treadmill in a heat chamber, so it's 100 plus Fahrenheit. You have a runner run till exhaustion, and you'll see that people's your core temperature climbs steadily as you run in hot conditions. And once it gets up to about 104 Fahrenheit, you say, that's it. I can't take it anymore. I'm done. You either fall off the treadmill or you step off the treadmill. And, you know, you can do all sorts of manipulations. You can dunk people in ice water beforehand so they're cool, or you can heat them up in a hot bath beforehand. And that changes how long they last, but it doesn't change the really universal or semi-universal fact that there's a circuit breaker in your brain that kicks you off the treadmill at 104 Fahrenheit. And so that's how, that's, you know, that was a body of research in the 90s that led to this idea that we have a critical temperature. But then, the extrapolation from that is, oh, well, in the real world, when you see people keeling over in hot conditions, it's because they've hit 104 degrees Fahrenheit. But actually, if you go out into the real world, there's no treadmill forcing you to keep going at a certain pace. You immediately modify, if it's a hot day, from the moment you start running on a hot day, you'll be going more slowly than you would, or you know, within a few strides. You sort of immediately integrate this information into your decision making. And so 99.999% of people who go out and run a 10K on a very hot day, so the Peachtree 10K in Atlanta or something like that, they moderate their performance such that their temperature never gets to 104 degrees. Their brain, whether it's voluntary or involuntary or through experience or through sort of evolution or whatever, they control their efforts such that they reach the finish line with their temperature below this critical threshold. So then you have to say, well, then what relevance do these studies on critical temperature have to actual real performance if almost nobody ever gets to that threshold and yet they run slower? So it wasn't that the critical threshold made them slow down. It wasn't that they ran as hard as they could, their temperature hit 104 and then they had to slow down, or the temperature hit 103.9. It's they were adjusting all the way to and anticipating the conditions they were facing to make sure they never hit that critical temperature. So sorry, Joanne, I'm sort of answering your question backwards. You're saying, how do they make lab studies apply to the real world? What I'm saying is there are fundamental problems and there are fundamental gaps, and the way to, you know, one of the ways to get around it is to take the studies out of the lab. And so that's where you see people analyzing results. You know, we live in a sort of brave new world of big data where everyone's marathon results are collected online and freely available. There's big databases that people are starting to parse for patterns. There's also there's the dawn of wearables. We now have greater ability than before to go out into the wild and, you know, the equivalent of kind of, you know, tagging a wildebeest and then with a microchip and figuring out what they actually do in the wild rather than the zoo. Well, we're doing that with marathoners and with, you know, with other athletes, trying to figure out how they move, what their physiological responses are to different kinds of exercise. But I think there's still a long way to go there.
It's science, and this is the way we do it. We physicists do it. Joanne knows that you simplify things and you say, yes, this is synthetic and it's simplified, but if I've designed this well, I'm getting at some essence of the problem, and I can gain understanding. And so you do
it's,
it.
It's the spherical cow, right?
Like it's exactly
the spherical cow. This is how cows roll.
But the key point is
assume
not that
all cells are a perfect sphere.
Yeah. The key point is not that you've simplified it, and you know what relevance is that to the real world. The point is you may have some insight. And you can now say, did I learn something? I can test it in another way and see if it is valid there. And so you test the things that you learn about and see whether they hold up, see whether they work, see when they fail to try to get some insight into a better problem that you can look at. It's stepwise refinement rather than, oh, here's the experiment that solved everything. That never happens. That's not science, right?
That's not how it works, but that's the pitfall that you have to be really aware of understanding what your simplifications were and what context, as you said, where that simplification might fail. Because if you understand that tells you something useful too.
And the danger is always if the result of a spectacular test or something immediately jumps into headlines. And now we know the answer is never go 104 degrees because you'll certainly die or you'll collapse. Well, that's an oversimplification and that's just always bad.
Why don't we ask the question, in your memory, has there been some sort of pronouncement in sports science that was found to be so wrong? Like it just jumped in the headlines. Everybody says, yeah. If you recall any.
Yeah, you know, like this is controversial again, but what I'll say that probably the most sort of most influential example of that sort is dehydration. And this is another classic example where you do studies in the lab where you dehydrate someone by 2% deliberately and you find that their performance is compromised. But that's not the same as out in the real world, someone who's drinking as much as they want, but allows themselves to get dehydrated by 2% during exercise temporarily without feeling thirsty. And so, you know, the needle kind of bounces back and forth on this. And in the 90s, these pronouncements made the headlines about don't get dehydrated at all. However much you sweat, you should be replacing that. And people have backed, you know, thanks to criticisms of that approach, I think the science has backed away from that. Although I think that message is so powerful, and to be frank, it's encouraged by, you know, sports drink companies.
Yeah.
So that, you know, there's a profit motive there. So that message is still out there, even though scientists for at least a decade have been saying, it's not quite as simple as that. You know, don't aim for 0% dehydration.
But then as you said in the book, what about Pablo Valencia?
Yeah. And you know, interestingly, I should say, so Pablo Valencia is this guy who back in about 1905 reportedly lasted 7 days in the desert with nothing but like his own urine and the juice of a few spiders or whatever that he killed. Since the book has come out, I chatted with the people who in charge of the Outside Magazine podcast who looked into that story, and they said there's a little bit of doubt about whether that, you know, as always, when you get fantastical tales of survival from 100 years ago, what they said is that the doctor who wrote up Pablo Valencia's tale in 1905, he had written up a sort of suspiciously similar tale a year or two earlier. So that makes you think, hang on. So, you know, and this is, you know, I was writing a book about physical limits. So I was looking into lots of things like how long has someone survived without water or without food or, you know, or how long can you hold your breath? And some of these are really hard to verify. Things like hunger strikes too. There's always sort of murmurs that, maybe someone's, you know, snuck in a peanut butter sandwich to him at some point. So,
yes.
I think Pablo Valencia, I think the story is probably true, but whether the timeline is exactly right. Something crazy happened.
Yeah, that leaves us with dehydration is not the big knob that determines everything.
Yeah, for me, the best real world counterexample to all the lab dogma is you look at marathoners who set world records. They lose 10% of their body weight. And so you can say, well, if they lost 0% of their body weight, they'd be even faster. Well, it's like, okay, you know, show me someone who's come anywhere close to that. That doesn't happen. The fastest marathoners in the world get massively dehydrated because that's the nature of the task.
Yeah, I've got that right here. I was going to say, you know, I quote you to say the fastest finishers tend to be the most dehydrated.
Wait, you lose a little bit of weight and maybe... Yeah, I don't. Is that appreciable that you losing that bit of weight makes you light enough to?
Well, 10% of your body weight is like for these marathoners, it's like 13 pounds or something like that. That's you know, you are lighter, and there's speculation and debate about the idea that tactical dehydration can be a physics advantage because you get lighter. I don't know if you deliberately I wouldn't advocate you deliberately dehydrating yourself or that, you know, any more than I would advocate like lopping off your arm just because it makes you lighter, but it probably is a happy side effect. And the other thing is it's just when you're running, for example, even if you, you know, it's just not comfortable to drink 6 liters of water while you're running as fast as you can. So there's always multiple factors that go into what's optimal.
Right. But, and I've got, this is about, there's someone here on Twitter asking a question. It's about dehydration. So that's why I don't want to move on too quickly. So he is asking, aren't the recommendations about things like dehydration really for the masses? I have read that part in the book, and these are extreme examples for elite athletes. But would we want those recommendations for the average person out there running?
Well, I definitely am not recommending to anyone that they should aspire to lose 10% of their body weight. And I don't recommend that in the book for anyone who hasn't read it. But the idea that some dehydration is not harmful, well, some of the studies that I talk about are with just general average marathoners. For example, studies where they look at, there's one in France where they just had about 500 finishers in a marathon, and they measured how much they were dehydrated and how fast they ran. And the fastest finishers, and we're just talking 3-hour marathoners, which are fast, but not 2-hour marathoners like the elites. Mm-hmm. And the faster you are, or the fastest finishers tended to be the most dehydrated, in a range of, you know, on average of maybe 4% or something like that. So 4% is not 10%, but it's also not 2% or 0%. So I think, and I just want to make absolutely clear, dehydration can be a real problem. If you're going running in the desert in Arizona, at noon, err on the side of caution. don't just wait till you're thirsty. Like dehydration is a real thing, but if you're under sort of normal conditions, if you're a little thirsty, that's actually not the end of the world, I think is maybe the takeaway. And you don't need to fear it quite as much as you might otherwise.
I was just thinking this as a bit of a switch then, that I kept having the thought sort of through the whole book that it's with the science, here's a study, here's some more books. Let's go watch people free dive. Let's go watch people climb mountains. And all of these activities and compare those, go back to the real world. I thought it was an allegory of how science actually works, which a lot of people, I think, don't understand very well and could use a good allegory for, which is to say, you know, here it is, you put out something, you say, we've done this experiment as we were talking about, and it looks like this is an important thing, can I test it? And you kept finding the most interesting counterexamples. Many people will think the science works by saying, I have proved this to be true. But generally, much more generally, the counterexample is the powerful tool that says, nope, that theory was wrong. That one's wrong. We haven't found one yet for this, so it's holding on. But there seem to be a lot of dramatic counterexamples to a lot of these theories as people try to find their way to understanding it about endurance, right?
Yeah, and I think that speaks a little bit to the complexity of endurance and to the fact that we're maybe, one of the researchers I spoke to makes the comparison to like the search for a grand unified theory in physics. And it's like, that's a nice idea, but I don't think there's any natural law that tells us we're necessarily going to have one equation or one theory that explains everything. And so anytime you get these big ideas, then as you said, like the way science progresses and I'm a science journalist, so I feel some guilt in the sort of public perception of how the sort of here's a study that proves this, and it's like it's that's not how, here's a to me it's like here's a study that's really interesting and tells us something. How much it tells us, we'll find out in the next decade as people kind of chip away at it, and as good scientists try to chip away at their own theories. You know, that like that's the real hallmark of a good scientist is you're really racking your brains trying to figure out, if my theory was wrong, what would that mean, and how could I show that? So let's find the weakest points and let's poke those weak points and see if we can find, because you can never prove something. All you can do is, as you said, propose an idea and wait and see if anyone can come up with a counterexample. And in endurance, as you said, it's there's a lot of counterexamples that pop up because the contexts are so different. You say, well, okay, maybe that's true for mountain climbing, but is that really true when we go under the ocean?
Do you feel like that we're there, with a lot of interest and activity and results, are we getting closer to asking better questions so that we can get better answers? because it's the question to me that is usually finding the right question is a big part of the problem.
I think so. And you know, at risk of you know, I don't mean to throw any particular researchers under the bus, but I think there've been a couple of waves of stepping up the game of the questions. And so I think in the 90s, the ideas that came out of Tim Noakes's lab in South Africa, so Tim Noakes is very well known for this idea called the central governor theory, which is, as we were talking about earlier, the idea that the brain is protecting you. And one of the big criticisms of that is no one really knows what the central governor theory is, because it kept evolving over time. And there's still never been any sort of canonical statement of what the theory is. And to me, Tim Noakes's great contribution, which deserves, you know, a ton of credit, is not that he formulated the right theory. It's that he asked the right question. Mm-hmm. He said, what about, which, you know, in a nutshell was, what about the brain? How does the brain figure in here? And he didn't have the answers, and maybe he still doesn't, you know, in some ways, but that question in the late 90s, it really, you can see a palpable shift in where research in this field went. It altered the course of thousands of scientists and their research. And I think there's been another step up in the last decade, a little less than a decade, where people have started to move past, you know, is the brain involved, and started to look at ways of, you know, quantifying and altering and changing the brain. So it went through a sort of observational phase of, let's try and prove that the brain is involved, or that, you know, in ways that are non-trivial or non-obvious. And now there's another generation. So I think there is, even if we're not coming to the right answers, I think the questions are getting better and better.
So with the central governor theory, so what if it's wrong? It was a very productive idea that advanced things a lot. And that's much better than having something that's correct but sterile.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, people get hung up on, you know, and this, you know, I should say, this is sort of another topic, but it's interesting in the modern era, you can follow along scientists on Twitter and other forms of social media, and you can see them interacting with each other. And you can tell in this field that it's a very, very active field, because people are going at each other's throats on Twitter. And there's a lot of criticism of, a lot of criticism of Noakes's work, and a lot of fixation on whether the, you know, a paper he wrote in 2004 is actually correct. Mm-hmm. And to me, that, like you said, that's missing the point. It's like, that wasn't, I mean, we should figure out whether that paper is correct, but the watershed moment was the asking of the question. And that's why those scientists are where they are today in that field, is because that question was asked, and it wasn't asked quietly or politely. He forced it onto the agenda, or against the wishes of probably most of the scientists at the time.
Mm-hmm. But that's a significant part of how science works. And we saw that in action throughout the book, which I think is one of its important contributions, that's not right at the surface of the facts and the research and the sports.
Right. And I, you know, I've read, you know, just in showing an interest in the things my kids do. So I've read several books of ultra marathoners and ultra whatever, Ironman type things. And I felt like, I really, really liked your book because I love science. And, you know, I just felt like it wasn't just, here's how, you know, I did this and changed my mind and did this. You know, it's not a biography, and it's not just, these are the things you should do, you know, because the books tend to fall into biography, or here's how you train, you know, eat only plants, et cetera, stuff like that, right? So, I felt like your book was so refreshing for this field. And I really appreciate it.
I'm glad you said that. And we were sort of chatting a little bit on this topic before we went on air about, you know, is this a sports book or a science book? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm really proud of that was, you know, kind of difficult to stick with along the way, was that I was really trying to resist the urge of boiling everything down to, what does this mean for, you know, how can I apply this in my everyday life? Now, I hope the book has useful things to say to people. I really think it does. In the last few chapters, I kind of get to that. But, you know, I spend a lot of time, especially the first four chapters, going through the history of the development of this field to get at precisely what Jeff was saying, to show to not just a drop down of like, here's what we think right now, but in order to understand the controversies today, you have to understand where the field came from, mm-hmm. and what all the, how all these different factions have built up and what the different towers of evidence are. And so I really was trying to say, let's talk about what's cool here. Let's talk about stuff that's interesting, and hopefully some of it is useful, but let's not make that the barometer of whether to include something. I'm going to talk about Robert Hooke's, first altitude chamber in the 1600s, not because anyone's going to go build themselves a crazy altitude chamber like he did, but because that's cool. Like, altitude tents were supposed to be this new thing in like 2002. This guy built one 400 years ago. It's amazing.
Well, there are different audiences, and to some of them, we can reassure them that there's plenty of really interesting sports talk in here. And for others, maybe because you've been on so many sports shows, here's our chance to say, but also this book, you have a lot of really fascinating, really good science that is really well reported.
Right, right. And I was going to say, I thought, how many times were you standing there going, man, I've got a degree in physics because I can evaluate what he's saying, what this researcher is saying about this or not. You have a way to look, is this sound, right?
It's definitely a case where it's like, I didn't really use Newton's laws at all in the sure. writing of this book. Much less the stuff I got into in grad school and beyond. None of that is relevant, but I think exactly what you're saying, that if nothing else, spending time as a scientist just gave me both an understanding of how, as we've been talking about, how scientific fields advance and how it's always way messier than you think, and that we don't necessarily need to hide that mess, that actually it's kind of interesting to see mm-hmm. how these ideas are clashing and intertwining. Mm-hmm. But also, I'm okay with talking to scientists, and I'm okay with reading complicated papers. I'm okay with reading formulas, and I'm okay with going to the researcher and saying, I don't really understand what you're talking about. And then after they explain it to me, saying, I still don't understand. Can you try another way? I think that the time I've spent sort of immersed in science, it's not so much about applying any of that directly, but about understanding the field and being willing to wade in and know that if someone's spending a lot of time, if someone's spending their career answering this question, there's probably something interesting there, even if it's hard to get to. If you're able to get down below the surface of what the paper is saying, mm-hmm. there's often a really interesting question that's not obvious if you just read the paper as an outsider.
And there is an aspect of critical assessment too that you go through. You're not harsh and clashing things, but choosing what to present, how to present it, and how to juxtapose. Here was someone's interesting idea, but here is something that tends to speak against that in the real world or in someone else's paper. And that's all a very important part of the process too.
Yeah, and I would say, like as I've said before, it's like I started working on this book in about 2009, so it's a long process. It's not just because I type really slowly, and it's not just because it took a long time to find all the studies. I don't think I could have written this book even 3 or 4 years ago, even though to some extent I had a lot of the raw materials gathered together, because I think I've been writing really specifically in this area for about a decade. And it's taken at least that long to build up a little bit of confidence to be willing to say, to call out things that I think are wrong, or at least, or, and there's a few places in the book, as you said, where I'm not trying to tear anyone apart or anything, mm-hmm. but where I'm willing to say, I think this was, the wrong approach. And here's this other research that I think was the right approach. And it takes, some people are happy to leap in and take sides without knowing the whole field. I'm very circumspect about that, and so I know that I could spend another 10 years and gain another level of confidence. But I think I've spent long enough in the field that I was willing to make some pronouncements and make some judgment calls, which inevitably you have to make in writing a book like this.
Well, and share some understanding. It takes spending some time with ideas to understand them at a close enough to the foundation that when you talk about them up here, that comes through somehow, so that there's a stronger sense of connection between the ideas, a better idea of how all of these things go together and rely on each other. This what I talked about is the allegory of how science happens, that I think is a really valuable thing. And so I think you're right. It shows that you've been working on this book for some time and spending a lot of time with these ideas, because that gives them a maturity and a depth of flavor that you just don't get any other way.
Yeah, thanks. And you know, it's like the 10 years on the book and you know, 15 years before that being obsessed with running. So the only problem with that approach is I'm like, how can I ever get to know another topic this well? I can't wait another 15 years to write my next book.
Right. Well, Endure also is about your book, you and the book, right? You endure.
Yeah.
So speaking of science and things that maybe are just on the cutting edge of science, your last section is about training the brain. And yeah, where is that now? You know, training the brain so we can, you know, have the metal to tough it out, right?
So, yeah, brain training is one of those topics that's it's a minefield, right? Like it's such a big profitable industry now. And so I'm talking brain training in general, the idea that you can do cognitive tasks to train your brain. It was maybe the year before, there was this huge meta-analysis of like every brain training study ever done. It basically concluded, whatever you train your brain to do, you get better at, but the transferability is, you know, if not zero, then unmeasurably small. So you can do Sudoku, you know, all day, every day. It's not going to make you better at crosswords or finding your car keys or whatever. And so that's a real, you know, that's a real warning light that should be flashing, you know, brightly and loudly when we talk about what I talk about, which is the idea of brain endurance training, which is the idea that you can identify some of the cognitive aspects of, okay, you want to run a race, you're going to have to keep pushing yourself. You're going to have to overcome your natural and well-justified urge to slow down. You're going to have to, it's the equivalent of you're holding your finger in a candle flame and every, you know, your impulses are to jerk it away and you're going to have to resist that. So you can have simple computer-based cognitive tasks that tax this sort of response inhibition. And the idea that researchers are exploring is that by doing that, by sitting in front of the computer doing response inhibition tasks, you can become a better marathoner, independent of what's going on in your legs. And the results so far have been impressive in a couple of small pilot studies presented at conferences. And again, this is, you know, one of those things where, okay, we should be hearing some warning bells. It's like, okay, small studies, pilot presented at conferences, not yet in journals. So, you know, I think it's an interesting area to pursue. I think there's questions about how practical it is. Like, even if you can train your brain, it's like maybe, you know, the time that you have to devote to it, like just go for a run,
exactly.
Just go outside and you'll get bigger benefit for almost all of us, for everyone except those who are already running, you know, 150 miles a week where they literally can't run another step without breaking. So I see it. And I would say the same thing about this as some of the other things that I wrote about in the book, things like electric brain stimulation, which also seems to be able to enhance endurance. To me, it's fascinating as a proof of principle. If you can enhance endurance by zapping the brain, that tells you that, you know, your limits under all circumstances are dictated in the brain, because if you can change the brain and change your limits, that means your limits were never entirely in the muscle. And it's the same with brain training. If you can sit someone at a computer 5 times a week for a couple months and make them better marathoners without ever running a step, that's a fascinating proof of principle. And, you know, and every time I write about this, then I get emails from people saying, where can I get this computerized task? And I'm like, why? Why do you want to do that? I understand it, like, and different people have different kind of thresholds of the desire for novelty and the desire for self-experimentation. Mine is relatively low. I'm really interested to find out about this stuff, but I'm not all that interested in trying it. But so I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in that field. I think it's teaching us new things. Whether it's going to end up altering how we live in the real world is to me still to say it's an open question is maybe an understatement.
So let's talk a minute about Roger Bannister, and then, you know, can we break the so-called limit of the marathon, right? Which is, this is how you start your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so first of all, let's say Roger Bannister, great guy, died just over a week ago. And, his autobiography was maybe the second book about running that I got when I was a teenager. And I can't count the number of times I've read it, certainly dozens and maybe more than that. Really interesting guy. Lots of mythology has built up around the idea, around his breaking of the 4-minute barrier. And I kind of, as I dig into that, I try and kind of puncture some of the myths that this was, some incredible feat of the mind that then, unlocked human potential and suddenly it became easy to break a 4-minute mile. This is an interesting stat that the Let's Run website dug up recently. There are more billionaires in the United States right now than there are people who run a 4-minute mile. Mm-hmm. It's a rare thing. And I don't know which I would rather have, but that says something about me maybe. But there's still no denying that, Bannister broke the 4-minute mile and then someone else did it the next month and mm-hmm. four people did it within the next year. And within a decade, it was, a high schooler doing it. So there's something about mental barriers or about there's a mental component to these barriers, even though it's definitely not all in the mind. And I have my own personal experiences, which I talk about in the book, about trying to break the 4-minute 1500, which was a similar kind of, there was this, unlocking of the gate at some point where all of a sudden, once I'd done it, I never struggled with it again. Now the 2-hour marathon, I think those factors, so the world marathon record right now is 2:02:57. So we're kind of getting close. We're within 3 minutes. And that's, it's taken maybe 15 years for the record to come down 3 minutes in the recently. So in theory, it's like, we're within a decade or two. I think there's a mental aspect to it. I think, it feels impossible to people, and that plays into things, and that once someone does it, that will lead other people under the barrier. But none of that changes the fact that 3 minutes is a ton of time to knock off a marathon when the marathon is already a highly professionalized sport, with lots of science and lots of monetary incentives. So I don't think there's a whole lot of low hanging fruit. And so I think getting to a 2-hour marathon, if and when we do, is not going to be a function of someone just waking up one morning and having a strong mental day. There's going to be physical and physiological things that happen. But once we get into the, right into the neighborhood, then it's going to, the person who does it is going to be a remarkable mental character. And he for the 2-hour marathon is going to lead other people underneath that barrier relatively soon afterwards.
We don't have to give away all the results about the Nike effort that you begin and then end with, but it seemed a telling story. And I just had the feeling, and maybe you intended it that way, after reading the entire book and then seeing how that ended, that it seemed to me that, was I wrong in feeling that it was doomed to failure because it was so synthetic anyway and there was no competition involved?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. It depends a little bit on how you define failure.
Yeah,
because it
didn't quite achieve certain goals.
It didn't achieve. Yeah, so look. It's in the public domain. So this Nike's breaking 2 effort. They didn't run a sub-2-hour marathon, but they came close, mm-hmm. and they came closer than I think just about anyone with any knowledge of the sport would have been willing to guests. So like you said, this was a very artificial synthetic effort. It attracted a ton of criticism, that it was sort of getting away from the meaning of the sport, it was all about, high tech shoes and illegal pacing arrangements and stuff. And so there's a sense, I would say there's a sense in which even if they had run under 2 hours, in a sense, it might've been even a greater failure. It would have been a failure because then you would have had this historic barrier broken under artificial conditions and it's kind of stealing the thunder of whoever might eventually do it under proper conditions. And I think in a sense, there would have been more of a backlash if they'd done it. Yeah. The fact that they didn't do it, it ended up being a performance that was greater than almost anyone expected, but it didn't fully steal anyone's thunder. So my impression was that even a lot of there were a ton of critics of the project, and understandably, but even most of them walked away saying, okay, that was actually a pretty impressive run. It was one of those things where, like you said, very synthetic conditions, no competition. So I went into that. I went to Italy to cover this, and my thought was like, this is probably going to be the most boring race I've ever watched because they were setting out at an exact pace, at 2 hour so marathon fine. Pace,
yeah,
behind pacers who were where their position was delineated with a laser line from shone from a pace car. It's like there are going to be no lead changes, no tactics. There is nothing that is going to happen for the next 2 hours except that at some point each of these three runners will start to blow up. And I thought it's going to be so boring. And yet it wasn't. And I think that was the, millions of people watched it around the world. They got up in the middle of the night to watch the live stream. And just watching the comments scroll by on Twitter was, I think it's fair to say that, the overwhelming response was, whoa, this is way more interesting and way more powerful than I thought. Watching this guy just, because he was, Kipchoge was just clearly on the razor's edge of what he was capable of. And since he's the greatest marathoner in the world right now, of what humans are capable of. And it was just this sense of watching, the very edge of human capability, combined with human frailty as you get towards the end of the race and you see that it's probably not going to happen. And you kind of looking at him and can he do it? And what is behind those eyes? Can he find another gear to go? So anyway, all of which is to say, I get all the criticisms of it, but I walked away thinking that was way more cool than I expected. And so I would chalk it up as a success in that respect.
So we learned a lot, and I have relevant to that, I think one more quotation and then I can give it back to Joanne, but the idea of technology and those remarkable shoes that Nike came up with, and I, was reading and I exclaimed, 4%, I can't believe 4%. But anyway, I thought it was very perceptive when you wrote that technology, you're talking about performance enhancing suits and shoes and bikes and all of these things. You say technology evolves, but when it evolves so quickly that it effectively picks winners, that's a problem. And I thought that was a very nice line to draw in that question that I think everyone wonders about.
Thanks. And I should say that that thought, I'd have to look up the name. I'm blanking on the name. There's an ethicist at the Hastings Institute in New York State who's written a lot about performance enhancing drugs and technology. And that's something I drew on his work to sort of come up with that idea that it's not so much does technology help you is because if there's a level people's intuition is that as long as it's a level playing field, it's okay. And so it's in times of transition, and you can think of, there's all these historical examples. It's like when pole vaulters went from bamboo poles to fiberglass poles. Well, no one right now is like, fiberglass poles are a cheat. That's no fair. That's because everyone has them. But there was a time when the first people who got fiberglass poles were automatically the winners. And so it was the transition that's the problem. And so with a sport like running, there's a sort of implicit expectation, more so than in other sports, I think, that it's going to be very simple and very kind of just, person, human against human. And so that's another ingredient. But I think that was where the objection to the Nike shoes came, I think, was the idea that only Nike athletes had them. And so it's a tricky one, though. Like, it's very hard to sort out what's a sort of presentist perspective where you're like, you imagine that the way things are right now is the way nature intended them to be. Yes. Whereas it's like, well, if you were born 20 years ago, you would have said that what we're doing now is totally, you know, unacceptable. So it's hard to balance the sort of the tradition with just the progress of life.
Right. Well, Alex, your book was great. Thank you for writing a great science book about science books, I would say, but this particular book about endurance, which actually I keep wanting to call it endurance, but there's like three other books called endurance.
So, which is why this one's not called endurance.
Exactly. So, Alex, thank you so much for joining us and for your insight and for putting a scientist's eye on this field. So those of you who want to get the book, I highly recommend it. I really, really enjoyed it. I know Jeff did too, actually. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. Alex, thank you. I'll be keeping my eye out for more of your stories. I remember reading your story about the free divers in the New Yorker not mm-hmm. too long ago. So you're out there. You've got articles everywhere.
Well, thanks, Joanne, and thanks, Jeff. It's a pleasure to have this chat and to really get into the science part of the book, because that was the driving interest for me, that it was following my curiosity on the science.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, everybody, for joining us and for submitting questions on Twitter. And we'll see you again soon.